The Golden Bough dropped her anchor at the head of the channel in Elephant Lagoon, and at once Llewellyn set his crew to work pumping out the bilges and repairing the storm damage to the hull and the rigging. A full gale still raged overhead, but though the surface of the lagoon was whipped into a froth of white wavelets, the high ground of the heads broke its main force. Cornelius Schroeder fretted to go ashore. He was desperate to get off the Golden Bough and rid himself of this company of Englishmen whom he had come to detest so bitterly. He looked upon Lord Cumbrae as a friend and an ally, and was anxious to join him and ask him to act as his second in the affair of honour with Vincent Winterton. In his tiny cabin he packed his chests hurriedly, and when a man could not be spared to help him, lugged them up onto the deck himself. He stood with the pile of his possessions at the entry port, staring out across the lagoon to Cumbrae's shore base. The Buzzard had set up his camp on the same site as Sir Francis Courtenay's, which Schroeder had attacked with his green jackets. A great deal of activity was taking place amongst the trees. It seemed to Schroeder that Cumbrae must be digging trenches and other fortifications, and he was puzzled by this. He saw no sense in throwing up earthworks against an enemy that did not exist. Llewellyn would not leave his ship until he was certain that the repairs to her were well afoot, and that in all other respects she was snugged down and secure. Eventually, he placed his first mate, Arnold Fowler, in charge of the deck, and ordered one of his longboats made ready. "Captain Llewellyn," Schroeder accosted him, as he came to the ship's side. "I have decided that with Lord Cumbrae's agreement I will leave your ship and transfer to the Gull of Murray." Llewellyn nodded. "I understood that was your intention, and in all truth, Colonel, I doubt there will be many tears shed on board the Golden Bough when you depart. I am going ashore now to find where we can refill the water casks that have been contaminated with seawater during the gale. I will convey you and your possessions to Cumbrae's camp, and I have here the fare money which you paid to me for your passage. To save myself further unpleasantness and acrimonious argument, I am repaying this to you in full." Schroeder would have dearly loved to give himself the pleasure of disdainfully refusing the offer, but those few guineas were all his wealth in the world, and he took the thin purse that Llewellyn handed him, and muttered reluctantly, "In that, at least, you act like a gentleman, sir. I am indebted to you." They went down into the longboat, and Llewellyn sat in the stern sheets, while Schroeder found a seat in the bows and ignored the grinning faces of the crew and the ironical salutes from the ship's officers on the quarterdeck as they pulled away. They were only halfway to the beach, when a familiar figure, wearing a plaid and a beribboned bonnet, sauntered out from amongst the trees, his red beard and tangled locks blazing in the sunlight, and watched them approach with both hands on his hips.
"Colonel Schroeder, by the devil's steaming turds!"
Cumbrae roared as he recognised him.
"It gladdens my heart to behold your smiling countenance."
As soon as the bows touched the beach, Schroeder leapt ashore and seized the Buzzard's outthrust hand. "I am surprised but overjoyed to find you here, my lord." The Buzzard looked over Schroeder's shoulder and grinned widely.
"Ah! And if it's not my beloved brother of the temple, Christopher Llewellyn, well met, cousin, and God's benevolence upon ye."
Llewellyn did not smile, and showed little eagerness to take the hand that Cumbrae thrust at him as soon as his feet touched the sand. "How do you do, Cumbrae? Our last discourse in the Bay of Trincomalee was interrupted at a crucial point, when you left in some disarray."
"Ah, but that was another land and long ago, cousin, and I'm sure we can both be magnanimous enough to forgive and forget such a trifling silly matter."
£500 and the lives of 20 of my men is not a trifling and silly matter in my counting house. And I'll remind you that I am no cousin nor any kin of yours," Llewellyn snapped. His legs were stiff with the memory of his old outrage. But Cumbrae placed one arm around his shoulder and said softly,
"In Arcadia habito."
Llewellyn was obviously struggling with himself, but he could not deny his knightly oath, and at last he gritted the response, "Flumen sacrum bene cognosco."
"There you are," the Buzzard boomed with laughter. "That was not so bad, was it? If not cousins, then we're still brothers in Christ, are we not?"
"I would feel more brotherly towards you, sir, if I had my £500 back in my purse."
"I could set off that debt against the grievous injury that you inflicted on my sweet gull and my own person,"
The buzzard pulled back his cloak to display the bright scar across his upper arm.
"But I am a forgiving man with a loving heart, Christopher, and so you shall have it. I give you my word on it. Every farthing of your £500, and the interest to boot."
Llewellyn smiled at him coldly. "I will delay my thanks until I feel the weight of your purse in my hands." Cumbrae saw the purpose in his level gaze, and without another look at the Golden Bough's row of gunports and the handy businesslike lines of her hull, he knew that they were evenly matched, and it would be hard pounding if it came to a fight between the two ships, just as it had been 4 years previously in the Bay of Trincomalee.
"I don't blame you for trusting no man in this knotty world of ours. But dine with me tonight, here ashore, and I'll place the purse in your hands. I swear it to you."
Llewellyn nodded grimly. "Thank you for that hospitality, sir. But I well remember the last time I availed myself of one of your invitations. I have a fine cook on board my own ship who can provide me with a meal more to my taste. However, I will return at dusk to fetch the purse you have promised me."
Llewellyn bowed and returned to his longboat. The buzzard watched him go with a calculating look in his eyes. The longboat headed up the lagoon towards the stream of fresh water that flowed into its upper end.
"That dandy bastard has a nasty temper," he growled,
and beside him Schroeder nodded. "I have never been so pleased to be rid of somebody so unpleasant and to be standing here on this beach and appealing to your friendship as I am now."
Cumbrae looked at him shrewdly. "You have me at a disadvantage, sir," he said. "What indeed are you doing here, and what is it that I can do for you in good friendship?"
"Where can we talk?" Schroeder asked.
Cumbrae replied, "This way, my old friend and companion in arms."
Led Schroeder to his hut in the grove and poured him half a mug of whisky.
"Now tell me, why are you no longer in command of the garrison at Good Hope?"
"To be frank with you, my lord, I am in the devil's own fix. I stand accused by Governor van der Velde of a crime that I did not commit. You know well how bitterly he was obsessed by envy and ill will towards me," Schroeder explained. And Cumbrae nodded cautiously without committing himself.
"Please go on."
10 days ago the governor's wife was murdered in a fit of lust and bestial passion by the gardener and executioner of the company."
"Sweet heavens!" Cumbrae exclaimed. "Slow John! I knew he was a madman. I could see it in his eyes. A blithering maniac. I'm sorry to hear about the woman, though. Oh, she was a delicious little muffin. Fair put a bone in me breeches just to look at those titties of hers, she did.
Von der Velde has falsely accused me of this foul murder. I was forced to flee on the first available ship before he had me imprisoned and placed on the rack. Llewellyn offered me passage to the Orient, where I had determined to enlist in the war that is afoot in the Horn of Africa, between De Presta and the Great Mogul."
Cumbrae's eyes lit up, and he leaned forward on his stool at the mention of war, like a hyena scenting the blood of a battlefield. By this time he was heartily bored with digging for Frankie Courtney's elusive treasure, and the promise of an easier way to fill his holds with riches had all of his attention. But he would not show this posturing braggart just how eager he was. So he left the subject for another time, and said with feeling and understanding,
"You have my deepest sympathy and my assurances of any aid I am able to render."
His mind was seething with ideas. He sensed that Schroeder was guilty of the murder he denied so vehemently. But guilty or not, he was now an outlaw and he was placing himself at Cumbrae's mercy. The buzzard had been given ample demonstration of Schroeder's qualities as a warrior, an excellent man to have serve under him, especially as he would be completely under Cumbrae's control by virtue of his guilt and the blood on his hands. As a fugitive and a murderer, the Dutchman could no longer afford to be too finicky in matters of morality.
"Once a maid has lost her virginity, she lifts her skirts and lies down in the hay with more alacrity the second time," the buzzard told himself happily, but reached out and clasped Schroeder's arm with a firm and friendly grip. "You can rely on me, my friend," he said. "How may I help you?"
"I wish to throw in my lot with you. I will become your man."
"And heartily welcome you'll be,"
Cumbrae grinned through his red whiskers with unfeigned delight.
He had just found himself a hunting hound, one perhaps not carrying a great cargo of intelligence, but nonetheless fierce and totally without fear.
"I ask only one favour in return," Schroeder said. The buzzard let the friendly hand drop from his shoulder, and his eyes became guarded. He might have known that such a handsome gift would have a price written on the underside.
"A favour?" he asked.
"On board the Golden Bough I was treated in the most shabby and scurvy fashion. I was cheated of a great deal of money, at hazard, by one of the ship's officers, and insulted and reviled by Captain Llewellyn and his men. To cap it all, the person who cheated me challenged me to a duel. I could find no person on board willing to act as my second, and Llewellyn forbade this matter of honour to be pursued until we reached port."
"Go on, please."
Cambry's suspicions were beginning to evaporate as he realized where the conversation was heading.
"I would be most grateful and honored if you could consent to act as my second in this affair, my lord."
"That's all you require of me?"
He could hardly credit that it would be so easy. Already he could see the profits that might be reaped from this affair. He had promised Llewellyn his £500, and he would give it to him, but only when he was certain that he would be able to get the money back from him, together with any other profit that he could lay his hands upon. He glanced out over the waters of the lagoon. There lay the Golden Bough, a powerful warlike vessel. If he were able to add her to his flotilla, he would command a force in the Oriental Oceans that few could match. If he appeared off the Great Horn of Africa with these two vessels, in the midst of the war that Schroeder had assured him was raging, what spoils might there be for the picking?
"It'll be my honour and my pleasure to act for you," he told Schroeder. "Give me the name of the dastard who's challenged you, and I'll see to it that you obtain immediate satisfaction from him."
When Llewellyn came ashore again for dinner, he was accompanied by two of his officers and a dozen of his seamen carrying cutlass and pistols. Cambry was on the beach to welcome him.
"I have the purse I promised you, my dear Christopher. Come with me to my poor lodgings and take a dram with me for loving friendship and for the memory of convivial days we passed in former times in each other's company. But first, will you now introduce me to these two fine gentlemen of yours?"
"Mr. Arnold Fowler, first mate of my ship." The two men nodded at each other. "And this is my third officer, Vincent Winterton, son of my patron, Viscount Winterton.
Also, so I am informed, a paragon at hazard, and a mean hand with the dice."
Cumbrey grinned at Vincent, and the young man withdrew the hand he was on the point of proffering.
"I beg your pardon, sir, but what do you mean by that remark?"
Vincent inquired stiffly.
"Only that Colonel Schroeder has asked me to act for him. Would you be good enough to inform me as to who is your own second?"
Llewellyn cut in quickly.
"I have the honour to act for Mr. Winterton." "Indeed. Then we have much to discuss, my dear Christopher. Please follow me. But as it is Mr. Winterton's affairs we will be discussing, it might be as well if he remained here on the beach."
Llewellyn followed the buzzard to his hut and took the stool that he was offered.
"A dram of the water of life?" Llewellyn shook his head. "Thank you, no. Let us come to the matters at hand."
"Ah, you are always impatient and headstrong."
The buzzard filled his own mug and took a mouthful. He smacked his lips and wiped his whiskers on the back of his hand.
"You'll never know what you're missing. 'Tis the finest whiskey in all the islands. But here, this is for you."
He slid the heavy purse across the keg that served him for a table. Llewellyn picked it up and weighed it thoughtfully in his hand.
"Count it if you will," the buzzard invited him. "I'll take no offence."
He sat back and watched with a grin on his face, sipping at his mug, while Llewellyn arranged the golden coins in neat stacks on the top of the keg.
500 it is, and 50 for the interest. I am obliged to you, sir."
Llewellyn's expression had softened.
"Well, it's a small price to pay for your love and friendship, Christopher,"
Cumbrey told him. "But now, to this other matter. As I told you, I act for Colonel Schroeder."
"And I act for Mr. Winterton," Llewellyn nodded. "My principal will be satisfied with an apology from Schroeder."
"You know full well, Christopher, that my lad will no give him one. I'm afraid that the two young puppies will have to fight it out."
"The choice of weapons lies with your side," said Llewellyn. "Shall we say pistols at 20 paces?
"We'll say no such thing. My man wants swords."
"Then we must agree. What time and place will suit you?"
"I leave that decision to ye."
"I have repairs to make to my rigging and hull. Damage we sustained in the gale. I need Mr. Winterton on board to help with these. May I suggest 3 days hence, on the beach at sunrise?" The Buzzard tugged at his beard as he considered this proposal. He would need a few days to make the arrangements he had in mind. 3 days' delay would suit him perfectly.
"Agreed," he said,
and Llewellyn rose to his feet immediately and placed the purse in the pocket of his tunic.
"Will you not take that dram I offered ye now, Christopher?"
Cumbrey suggested. But again Llewellyn declined. "As I told you, sir, I have much to do on board my ship." The Buzzard watched him go down the beach and step into his longboat. As they were rowed back to where the Golden Bough was anchored, Llewellyn and Winterton were in deep and earnest conversation.
"Young Winterton is in for a surprise. He can never have seen the Dutchman with a sword in his hand to have agreed so lightly to the choice of weapons."
He swigged back the few drops of whiskey that remained in his mug and grinned again.
"We shall see if we cannot arrange a little surprise for Christopher Llewellyn also."
He banged the mug onto the keg top and bellowed,
"Send Mr. Bowles to me, and be quick about it."
Sam Bowles came smarming in, wriggling his whole body like a whipped dog to ingratiate himself with his captain. But his eyes were cold and shrewd.
"Sammy, my boy."
Cumbrae gave him a slap on the arm that stung like a wasp, but did not upset the smile on the man's lips.
"I have something for you that should be much to your taste. Listen well."
Sam Bowles sat opposite him and cocked his head so as not to miss a word of his instructions. Once or twice he asked a question or chortled with glee and admiration as Cumbrae unfolded his plans.
"You've always wanted the command of your own ship, Sammy, me laddie. This is your chance. Serve me well and you shall have it. Captain Samuel Bowles. How does that sound to you?"
"I like the sound of it powerful well, your grace." Sam Bowles bobbed his head. "And I'll not let you down."
"That you won't," Cumbrae agreed. "Or not more than once you won't, for if you do, you'll dance me a merry hornpipe while you dangle from the maid yard of McGowl."
The river banks were lined with wild willow and dark green acacia trees, which were covered with a mantle of yellow blossom. The river ran broad and deep, slow and green between its rocky piers. The sandbanks were exposed, and as they looked down upon them from the steep slopes of the valley, Sukeena shuddered and whispered, "Oh, what foul and ugly creatures! Surely these are the very dragons we spoke of."
"They are dragons indeed," Hal agreed as they gazed down at the crocodiles that lay sunning on the white beach. There were dozens of them, some not much larger than lizards, and other brutes with the beam and length of a ship's boat, massive grey monsters which surely could swallow a man whole. They had found out how ferocious these creatures were on their first attempt to ford the river, when Billy Rogers had been seized by one and dragged beneath the surface. They had not recovered any part of his body.
"I tremble at the thought of trying to cross again, with these creatures still guarding the river," Sukeena whispered tremulously.
"Aberley knows them from his own land to the north, and his tribe have a way of dealing with them." On the rocky bluff, high above the river where the crocodiles could not reach, they stacked the piles of eland meat, which were already beginning to stink in the hot sunlight. Then Hal sent some of the men in search of the forest floor for dried logs that would float high in the water. Under Ned Tyler's instruction, they shaped them with the cutlasses, although Hal hated to see the fine steel edges dulled and chipped. While this was being done, Alsuda, with Sukeena helping him, carefully slit the wet eland hides into long, tough ropes as thick as her little finger. Aberley sought out the species of tree he needed, and then chopped short, supple stakes from its branches and carried bundles of these back to where the others were working. Big Daniel helped him to sharpen both ends of these short, resilient pieces of green wood into spear points and harden them in the fire. Then, using a log of the correct circumference as a template, the two powerful men bent each stake around the log until it formed a circle, the sharpened points overlapping. While they held them in place, Hal lashed the ends together with strips of the raw eland hide. When they gingerly released the tension, the coiled stakes were like the loaded steel springs of a musket lock, ready to fly open if the retaining strip of hide was severed. By sundown, they had finished work on a pile of these snares. They had learned from their encounter with the lion pride, and on this night they hoisted the legs of eland meat high into the top branches of one of the tallest trees that grew along the banks of the broad river. They built their stockade well downstream from this cache of meat, and made certain that the walls were of sturdy logs, and that the entrance was blocked with freshly cut thorn branches. Though they slept little that night, lying and listening to the hyena and the jackal howling and gibbering below the tree where the meat hung, the lions did not trouble them again. In the dawn they left the stockade to begin work once more on their preparations for the river crossing. Ned Tyler finished the construction of the raft by lashing the poles together with rawhide rope. "'Tis a rickety vessel," Sukina eyed it with obvious misgivings. "One of those great river dragons could overturn it with a flick of its tail. That is why Aberley has prepared his snares for them." They went back up the slope to where Althuda and Swainchi were helping Aberley wrap the coiled greenwood circlets with a thick covering of half-putrid eland meat. "The crocodile cannot chew his food," Aberley explained to them as he worked. "Each of these lumps of meat is the right size for one of the monsters to swallow whole." When all the baits had been prepared, they carried them down to the water's edge. As they approached the sandbank where the great saurians lay like stranded logs, they shouted, clapped their hands, and fired off the muskets, creating a commotion that alarmed even these huge beasts. They raised their massive bulks on short, stubby legs and lumbered to the shelter of their natural element, sliding into the deep green pools with mighty splashes and setting up waves that broke upon the far bank. As soon as the sandbank was clear, the men rushed out and placed the lumps of stinking meat along the water's edge. Then they hurried back and climbed up to where the women waited on the safety of the high bluff above the river. After a while, the eye knuckles of the crocodiles began to pop up everywhere over the surface of the pool, and then to move in slowly towards the sandbank. "These are cowardly, sneaking beasts," Aberley said, with hatred in his tone and revulsion in his expression. "But soon, when they smell the meat, their greed will overcome their fear." As he spoke, one of the largest reptiles lifted itself out of the shallows at the edge and waddled cautiously out onto the sandbank, its massive crested tail ploughing a furrow behind it. Suddenly, with surprising speed and agility, it darted forward and seized one of the lumps of eland meat. It opened its jaws to their full stretch as it strained to swallow. From the bluff they watched in awe as the huge lump of meat slid down into its maw, bulging the soft white scales on the outside of its throat. It turned and rushed back into the pool. But immediately another of the scaly reptiles emerged and gobbled a bait. There followed a general melee of long, slithering bodies shining wet in the sunlight that hissed and snapped and tumbled over each other as they fought for the meat. Once every bait had been consumed, some crocodiles splashed back into the pool, but many settled down again in the sun-warmed sand from where they had been disturbed. Peace fell over the riverbank again, and the kingfishers darted and hovered over the green waters. A great grey hippopotamus thrust out its head on the far side of the pool and gave vent to a raucous grunt of laughter. His cows clustered around him, their backs like a pile of shiny black boulders. "Your plan has not worked," said Saba in Dutch. "The crocodiles are unharmed and still ready to fall upon any of us who goes near the water." "Be patient, Saba," Aberley told him. "It will take a while for the juices of their stomach to eat through the rawhide. But when they do, the sticks will spring open and the sharpened ends will pierce their guts and stab through their vitals.